This is David Moore. The date is March the 4th, 2016, and talking to Bill Halbert, continuing on our discussion from the previous tape about his experiences during World War II and afterwards. We stopped the last tape as the war progressed and the different bases where he was assigned, and now we're starting with his recollections of VE Day or Victory Europe Day. So, Bill, tell me what you can recall from the times when you first heard that the Germans had surrendered.
Well, I think, firstly, I feel it was no surprise, because it was just visible. You just knew something was big was about to happen, and we were progressing so rapidly, and they were degressing, if that's the right word. Yeah, probably. But I think it's what we'd all been looking for, and we were just elated to the point that we just wanted to celebrate by any way we could. Mm-hmm.
And at the time, you were still assigned to Dole.
Dole in France.
Mm-hmm. Did they have you do any missions after the Germans surrendered?
I can't answer that question, to be honest. I flew quite a few missions. The very last period, I have record of being flown the last combat mission of my unit against the Germans, and then also against a German battleship that was docked at Bordeaux on the west coast of France. We all were flown either at or just before the end of the war. But I think there were no more combat missions flown. There may have been some intelligence committed just to go and look at the amount of damage done. And one of the things that might answer this question is that at the end of the war and immediately afterwards, you see all the different missions that we've flown over the years, the people who maintained the aircraft back at home base never were able to see what we were doing. They couldn't see the damage, the devastation was being created against the Germans. So we started a program wherein we take the crew chiefs and the guys that worked on the ground, the armors, the maintenance guys, take them up on a combat mission, but with no bombs or rockets, and fly over the German targets that we had hit to show them what kind of damage they were involved in getting themselves involved with.
And you were saying this was after the war?
Immediately afterwards.
Oh, that's interesting.
I'd say the next day or the two or three or four or five days later, just almost immediately afterwards. Mm-hmm. And that's what it was for, to show the appreciation of the ground crews that have helped make come about all it did.
I don't think we talked much about, just looking back, I think we forgot to talk about the Germans. We did talk about tactics, but we didn't talk about the ME-262.
Okay.
The German, you remember that? We've talked about this before, but I believe you may recall we didn't really talk about that last time too much. It's worth talking about, I think.
I agree.
Okay. So before, let's rewind, go back before the Germans surrendered. In the months just before VE Day, I believe I recall the Americans and the Allies had air superiority for the most part.
Yes,
you could fly without too much worry.
That's right.
But the Germans had come up with this new jet aircraft known as the Messerschmitt.
The first jet airplane.
The Messerschmitt 262, right?
Right, yes.
And you had occasion to meet some of these, I guess.
So. Yes, you might say Messerschmitt, they know that's the aircraft manufacturer.
That's
well,
right.
You and I do, but I don't know what that's really.
Okay.
Yes, I had that occasion specifically April 17, 1945 is the first time I remember seeing the ME-262.
And what happened when you saw him?
Okay, just pause there for a minute. I wanted to say something else. I don't know whether it could come before.
Oh, we can keep that on, unless you. That'd be okay.
I want to say that the Germans, after the appearance of the 262 in the early spring of 45, they never attacked our targets, but they did attack. Now let me tell you how I want to say what I want to say. I'll come back to that. There's some a little thing I'm hung up on at the moment.
Okay. So the first time you ran into the 262 was in April.
Yes.
And what do you recall about the first time did you know the Germans had these aircraft?
We had been briefed before the mission that they were likely to appear, but not likely to attack us as a unit. And so we went with eyes open and expecting them, and we first saw them as a flash through the sky, almost so fast. One, the thing that I remember mostly, and I've thought of this many times, is that they were moving so fast that you could hardly track them with your eyes. And the gunners couldn't track them with their turrets, guns. The turret wouldn't move fast enough to track the ME-262. You see, they were about 100 miles an hour faster than any aircraft that we had, any of the Allies had in that time period.
So you just saw them in a distance, kind of moving by you?
Yes, they had, the point I was trying to get to is that they had attacked ground targets well in advance of this, but they had not attacked aircraft in the air until about April 45. So we knew they were out there, but we just hadn't had the occasion to meet and involve with them until that time.
I see. Is this the only time you ran across them?
No, they attacked us several times after that.
Okay.
Yeah, but all in the same general area, which was in the south central part of Germany around the city of Munich and Augsburg. Ammunition, airfields, that sort of, that we were hitting, and they were attacking us from that locale.
Okay. Were they successful?
Yes.
In any of their passes?
On a few of them, we received some damage, but on April 17th, that's why I remember this, though, I have to tell you, disregard your pen for a moment.
Okay,
we had a base at Dole, France, and there were two B-26 groups on that base. And we had a mission plan for that day. The mission consisted of probably 24 sorties, 12 and 12. And one group went off in the morning, the 319th bomb group went off in the morning, the 320th bomb group went on in the afternoon. And we were all going against an ammunition depot in the Augsburg, Munich area. And the point I want to make is that we were all pre-briefed for the same general target and told that we might see enemy fighters. And in that particular case, we came in and sought the target and attacked the target. And the first group in the morning lost two airplanes to those ME-262s. And in the afternoon mission, I happened to be leading. We had a six-ship decoy flight to make the enemy think here comes the main force. We had a six-ship decoy flight, and I happened to be the leading aircraft in that mission against the same ammunition target in the same general area. They attacked us, but did not shoot anybody down, but we shot two of their aircraft down that afternoon mission. Not my aircraft necessarily, but my mission that I was leading fought and destroyed two aircraft in the air.
That's pretty good, especially when you consider what you're saying about not being able to track them with the turret.
Yeah.
Seems to me that the gunners were pretty much on their sights.
But that was one of the main missions. But they did attack us numerous times afterwards. But we became dominant in numbers and in the abilities, and they were not really very successful after that. So that was short-lived, and they knew, I'm sure, and we knew that we had them on the run and that the war was coming to an end.
Okay. Yeah. Very good. I'm glad we recalled mention that, because that's too important to have passed over to get to VE Day.
Right.
Okay. So what kind of, once VE Day happened, what kind of celebrations were you allowed to have?
The sky's the limit.
Okay, we'll leave it at that.
I don't know what I told you, but I was in Paris on VE Day.
I think you did tell me that before. I'm glad you brought that back up.
Remember now, the latter part of the war, probably the last 60 days, we were flying fully as many missions as we could possibly fly.
Mm-hmm.
I probably flew a third of my missions in the last 15 or 20 days of the war. And so at that, when the war then became over, I guess Uncle Sam felt that we needed some rest, so they allowed a few of us, the long-timers, to take an R&R break, and they gave us an option. We could go back into Germany, to Austria and that part of the country, or we could go to the Mediterranean coast, Marseille, Cannes, and Nice, France,
mm-hmm.
or we could go to Paris. And I chose Paris, mm-hmm. and I happened to be in Paris when VE Day was announced, having flown probably 10 missions in the last 10 days or 11 days for the right to have that day in France.
That's a great place to be. Yeah.
And I, you know, again, like in the other cases, the government had hired out a hotel, and it became mm-hmm. an R&R hotel.
I see.
Rest and recuperation, but it should be in there in case somebody really won't know what rest R&R is.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Of course, a lot of the guys call it I&I.
What did they designate I&I to be then?
Well, I guess we have to. Intoxication and intercourse. We don't need that.
Might not put that down. Okay. I&I.
But I was out on the streets with the Frenchmen on VE Day. I remember that. Of course, everybody was in a great spirit, great mood. And I was there for 2 or 3 days. That's all it was. It was just a short... Mm-hmm. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think they knew the war was about to come in, so they let these guys get out of there before it all came apart.
I see.
Yeah, I think that's what happened.
And
that's the
well,
that's
sure the French people were pretty happy about that.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Well, tell me about your reception once in returning home. Obviously, you're going back to Kilgore. So how did you make it back? Or how long did it take you afterwards to
get back? That's a good point, because I often remember, and I should remember the name of the ship, the service vessel that I rode in or on from Europe back to the mm-hmm. U.S. But I do not remember that. But it was a regular liberty ship transporting the what portion of the forces that they could spare at the time.
Mm-hmm. Did you come back with your crew or with your squadron or with
it was
with your
individually.
Group? Just individually.
Right.
Okay.
Just off the roster, and I don't know how they chose the roster, but it was not necessarily with the crew, no.
Well, they I do remember reading some accounts where after VE Day some units were brought in and briefed that okay, we still gotta fight the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to Japan. Did you have anything like that?
Oh yeah,
occur?
We had several threats, but we never moved to the point of taking action to go to mm-hmm. Japan. But there was that threat. But our first goal was to get rid of the aircraft that we had been flying. In fact, the Germans, some of their aircraft had already been destroyed, the ME-262s, and a sidelight on the ME-262s. It wasn't uncommon to see ME-262s, the first pure jet airplane, parked along the highways, along the autobahns, back mm-hmm. under the trees. They used that as a runway and in a staging area. And you could fly down low over that autobahn and look up, back up under the trees and see the nose and tails of aircraft because they were using that as a parking area. In the other case, then one of our requirements, as soon as the war was over, almost immediately, they started forming units and people, groups of people, to go in and take the German aircraft and destroy them if they could, and then take the American aircraft and fly them back to a depot somewhere in Germany and put them in a gully or a valley and set fire and bombs to them and destroy them on the ground.
And that was right after the war?
Right, immediately after the war. That was almost within the first few days they started that program.
And that's trying to understand why they would do that, especially with
the
Russian.
Well, they didn't have people to get them out of there, and a lot of them wouldn't fly. They were broken or couldn't get them back.
Oh, I see.
And it was such a long trip back, and I don't know either.
Okay.
Really, we've often wondered about it. Even then, what do you mean we're going to destroy my airplane?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, that's what we're going to do. But that's what it was about. So they couldn't, and I don't think there were any were left meant to be. Left in a condition that they could get any goodness out of them.
I see.
And I'm sure that some leader said, we'll never use these airplanes again. We're not going to see that Japan hadn't come about, and they figured they couldn't get that airplane back to Japan from Germany. You know, it just didn't fly long enough. It had been such a chore to start doing that. But some of the crews in that time period, some of the crews were tasked to leave their unit and don't go home. You go to this unit in the upper part of Germany and help get rid of some of the airplanes. And wherever they have to go, you'll be told. But a very loose kind of thing. Just get rid of them. I was not involved in all that because I was probably because I was about ready to come home anyway at the end of the war.
Because
so they
the
let
number
those,
of missions that you flew.
Right. So they let those folks come on home, and all the newcomers, then they're the ones that stayed behind and did this all that dirty work.
Mm-hmm. And those would be the ones that would eventually go on to Japan?
Probably
also?
So, yes. Mm-hmm. And I doubt that many of those folks did that. I think it all happened so quickly that that was an alternative that some leading general probably planned that. And whether it ever really happened, I don't know. I haven't looked at
VJ much of it. Day was not too long after.
That's right, it wasn't
VE.
Long
I think
enough.
It was maybe August. VE
I think, yeah, right,
was
August.
May.
Yeah.
So just a few months.
So I think there was a lot of that local destroying of equipment and handling people that were POWs and all that.
Okay. You came home on a Liberty ship, and then do you remember your point of debarkation where the ship landed?
It was in New Jersey, and I don't know if you can help me. It's a very common port of embarkation and debarkation, but I don't remember the name of the town. That's what I was saying earlier. I couldn't even remember. I think I'd have it stamped in my mind.
And then you took a train from there?
A train back from there back to Texas.
Okay. Did the train go right into Kilgore, or did you...
There was a train track through Kilgore, but it wouldn't. They funneled us back into San Antonio.
Okay.
And then from there, get home any way you can.
Okay. Did you recall meeting your family when you got back into Kilgore, or did you just?
I was here with just my dad and brother, so that there wasn't much.
You remember how you got back from San Antonio to Kilgore?
I think it was a bus.
Okay.
In fact, that's another experience I had, but it's a different time period. When I graduated from flying school as a brand new second lieutenant out of San Antonio, out of Houston, that's where I was. I'm going to Dodge City, Kansas, getting a B-26. So they give you 3 or 4 days worth of travel. So if you can find a way to get home, just to stop in, say hi, Mom, see you later. So I did, and I got on this bus going to Kilgore from Houston. There was about 3 gals on there. They wouldn't let me alone. I really had to fight them. Right? I fought them from Houston to Kilgore.
They just wanted to sit next to you and talk to you and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, they wanted to rub the bars. I was a brand new, bright, spanking lieutenant. They thought that was the greatest. But that's the only time it ever happened.
That's funny.
Well, there is one. I think I mentioned to you a gal that followed me all the way to Savannah, Georgia. Did I tell you that?
Oh, you did tell me about the preacher's daughter.
I was thinking about her the other day for some reason. I was just sort of going through what we're thinking. I said, I should have at least written her back, shouldn't have. But after the war's over, I never went to see her, never called her, and I never even dated her. I didn't know what was going on. I was naive, and I didn't know what was going on, really.
Oh, well. Sometimes girls have unusual imaginings, don't they?
Yeah.
Well, the rest of this here, it's not too much more.
Okay.
But we've done pretty good. We may wind up talking about some other stuff here, but most of this is about your thoughts on service in World War II, the impact that you feel like it made on America, and what impact America made by participating in and being part of the victory against these Axis powers. So. Mm-hmm. Just your thoughts on
that. That's a big order, but I can handle some of that. The thing that I had good feelings about is the fact that we were able to allow these countries to survive that war and prosper. And if you look back now at countries like in a different war, South Korea, look at Germany and other countries of Europe, how prosperous they are and how they've survived and how they've thrived since that time. So it just gives me, and I'm embarrassed and I'm frustrated and I'm mad at folks who don't appreciate what those countries have done to us now. And then the fact that we had to do it to them, but we did it without grudge, without ill feeling. We just did it because it had to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the thing. I never really wanted to go get the German or the Jap guy, but I just find myself thinking that now that we've allowed them to survive and they're a prosperous country, and I have sometimes a good feeling that they were able to do that based on our efforts.
Mm-hmm.
If you can help put that in better words, mm-hmm. I'd be much obliged.
Yes. Well, the thing that also has come to my mind, and I have noted in different readings and so forth, is in the years hence from World War II on to the present time, in the countries where America remained behind, in countries where America fought, and the countries they fought against, where America remained behind and helped rebuild that country, those are the prosperous countries.
That's right.
Japan, Germany, South Korea.
Right.
In the countries where America left, Vietnam, Iraq, parts of Afghanistan, those are the countries which have collapsed, caved in, and have turned into...
I agree. And see, there's a message there for the great leaders of our countries now.
Mm-hmm.
When you start settling out with people after the fact, then you ought to keep these things in mind, seems to me.
That's right. Do you think that World War II could have been won without America's participation? In other words, had America just remained isolationist, we'll just stay here, and say Pearl Harbor hadn't been bombed, that, of course, brought us in for sure. Do you think the Axis, do you think English could have pushed them back, the Germans? The Russians could have pushed the Germans back?
Oh, yeah. I think it would have happened had we not stayed and participated in the finish of War II.
In other words, the Germans would have taken them over.
I think so.
Yeah. Okay.
It may have been a compromise of sorts and not true surrender and complete turnover, but I think it would have been heavily, heavily influenced by them, yes.
Mm-hmm. How do you, in just talking to people now that you see on the streets, or even people your own age or close to your age, how do they impress you with their understanding or their knowledge of what happened during World War II?
a very severe lack of knowledge is what impressed me. I'm a docent at an aviation museum close by, and it's amazing to me how many folks come there and don't know what day, December 7th, Pearl Harbor occurred on, and they don't know anything at all about the start, the finish, or the workings of World War II. It's just amazing how little the younger generation, younger being probably from 35 downward.
How about the older generation? Do they have a pretty good,
I think they lived it. I think they do. Again, as a docent, I move around with a uniform that I wear while on duty. And it's amazing to me how many folks want to stop and thank me for what I've done and the service I've given. And I've not learned how much information they know about it, but the feeling that they have balances out my feelings and makes it seem even more worthwhile.
Do you think that your particular generation was particularly prepared for this kind of service? And that goes not only for, like we were talking at times before, not only servicemen, but America at home. Do you think that America, that particular generation, was specially prepared for that sort of thing?
Well, I think you'd have to say they were, because the way the industrial complex came to the front and turned out ship and aircraft at such a rapid rate, almost unbelievable amount. And so it had to happen, had to occur through the goodwill and the desires of the population to complete these projects. So I think it has to be, at least the leaders were sufficiently prepared to get the force on the track.
You're talking about industrial leaders?
Industrial complex.
But also the political leaders?
Yes, sir.
Did you feel like the military leaders were up to par?
I think they got up to par very quickly. They were not on track, because there, I'm sure, was too much 8-to-5 work for that military force until the truth really hit. So I think, yes, military-industrial complex.
Did you notice that when you got to your unit, and you were there for a pretty long time, in three different bases as you were going along in the time you were in Europe, but did you see a progression of the leadership abilities of the leaders over you? In other words, did you see where they got more competent as time went on?
Oh, yes.
Did you see that?
Very definitely. So, and I think that was largely in tribute to the GI himself, or the military man himself, realizing what it took to get to the winning side, and this had to be done, and they just bowed their heads and went full-blown to acquire all that knowledge. Mm-hmm. I think you got to give them a lot of that credit.
Was that? Do you think that was from the individual leaders getting better, learning lessons, or was it because they were replaced by better leaders, do you think? I mean, in your experience, I'm talking about in your group, in your squadron, your wing.
Oh, I think. What I want to say, I hate to say this, but I think that we had before the war, before World War II, before the win, we had so many military folks that were not true military members, and they really didn't want or make an effort to acquire a winning attitude. They're more an 8-to-5 job, more like, and I hate to say that, don't put this in there, more like the guard and the reserve that we see today. You know, they'll do it as long as they get paid for it and get recognition, but they don't really do the job like an active force. So is that case.
So, yeah, I'm reading you to say, or I'm hearing you to say that it seemed like good leaders came from outside mm-hmm. and were placed in positions, mm-hmm. which then became, mm-hmm. is not the full-time professional military man that really was yes. the one that did it. It was the civilian from the outside, the businessman, the right. doctor, the average everyday Joe that kind of came in and took over, took charge, used his ideas and innovations to kind of win the day, so to speak. The yeah. civilian soldier, the citizen soldier you're talking
yes,
about.
Yes, I agree. And I personally think, see, having been a military man for several years now, I've seen that with other guard, or what shall I call them, guard or reserve mm-hmm. units that don't go full-blown and get the job done. It's I can do it with the least effort. That's why mm-hmm. I want it. I don't want to get my stuff all dirty and messed up. We'll just let it ride, and I'll get around to it tomorrow. Mm-hmm.
What do you think were the life experiences that you had that prepared you to be a successful military man during the war?
I think two points I'd like to make. One is a subtle point with no mother and nobody back home to welcome me or correspond or feel sorry for me. I just felt that it freed me up to do my job in a better manner without interruption, without distraction from the folks back home. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the factors. And the other is having lived a young life that I did and being taught to survive on your own and do what's right, I think it made me a better GI, a better flyer in preparation for the potential shoot down or POW or whatever that mm-hmm. took a lot of things off my mind so that I could get on with the job without mm-hmm. the duty at hand.
Do you think that was a common experience?
I think so. I think mm-hmm. in large measure the folks that I dealt with, meaning that became friends of mine and we talked to around the subject, I think that's was a common thought. Mm-hmm. And for every person that got drunk and was drunk the morning to go fly the mission, mm-hmm. there was two guys like this I've just described.
Mm-hmm. I see. What do you think that, I guess, if you were to, and you probably have talked to, I know for a fact you've talked to future, or you talked to Americans about the future and things, what do you think they need to know about that era, the World War II period, that you think they should be able to carry on and pass on to their children, I guess?
I think one of the main thing probably would be learning or developing an ability to improvise, mm-hmm. respond to the needs of the time, whatever they may be. Don't take the easy way, but learn the best way. Learn and do the best way. Mm-hmm. In fact, the Air Force have an expression they've used for years called be as good as you can be, be the very best you can be. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, is the theme that I would try to share with and pass on to the next generation.
Okay. One of the things that I have come across in just studying the eras prior to World War II, mostly being the 20s and the 30s, the 20s being a time of great innovation, great new inventions, and new things were coming on. We had radio and picture shows, and the automobile was real big. All kinds of technology development was going on, different different things, new ideas and new inventions and all that sort of thing. And two of the things that I think were probably most influential, I think, on young people who were becoming of age to go fight or becoming of age to stay at home and build. And I think those things were radio and picture shows, and those being a means to inform and get people under a kind of a same thought process of what needed to be done, and actually bind them together. Do you agree with that? Do you think that
I agree with that. I certainly do.
And I'm talking about, you know, people obviously would listen to the radio for entertainment purposes, but during entertainment, there would be a broadcast.
That's right.
Here's a broadcast from the president, or
breaking news.
So where in the past, before radio, people might hear word through the grapevine or through rumor mill or whatever, or through newspapers. I'm sure there were magazines too, but that wasn't nearly as effective as a whole nation sitting around a radio listening to a president give his thoughts.
Fireside chat.
The fireside chats, exactly.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to the picture shows, you have mentioned, and others, that of course that was entertainment, but prior to every picture show there was always a quick video, maybe 5 minutes, 10 minutes, which gave a very vivid, upfront, close things that were happening in Europe before we got involved. And I think that got people collectively angry and determined and committed that if this comes to it, we're going to be prepared to go over there and fight.
Yeah, I agree.
After World War II, I guess, or maybe sometime during, but after, well, definitely for television, television came along afterwards. And of course, after every big event, you know, whether it's war or anything, there's always going to be movies made, television show programs, those kind of things. In the years after World War II, when you saw these things, what did you think about that? Did you think they were accurate? Did you think, didn't really want to watch movies about that sort of stuff because they were so inaccurate? I find that to be my experience. Is like, that's just Hollywood. That's nothing close to.
Well, I think I agree with that because of my limited experience in there. I can't see me ever having been involved in anything like that. So I think it must be make-believe to try to impress the folks back home. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're, well, I guess that's what I'm trying to say, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think, see, because I've had it so good in my military life, is that I find it difficult for me to talk about the bad things. Mm-hmm. And so I think that ties to what you're saying, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I guess that, unless there's anything else, can you think of any other thoughts?
Well, yeah, except, and I've said this already two or three times, I guess, but I still feel that I had it so good in the military that I really found myself sometimes wishing that I had participated more to learn more about what the world situation was, mm-hmm. either the locale or the people or the country itself. I really have felt that I wish I could go there. I didn't feel that strong enough to volunteer, but I really had a secret feeling that maybe I could go and get, not get done what they're doing or what they have done to them necessarily, but just, I haven't done my part. I think that's the feeling that I sometimes get.
Mm. Because of the sacrifices of so many.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's pretty common
for
military men that come back and, you know, they had a positive experience, or maybe not as negative, and some just said, everything go wrong.
I wonder if this war is ever over, that we're in now. You think we'll ever get to be a stable world so that we won't have continual skirmishes, whatever they may be called? You think we'll ever get to that point?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
You
can't kill all the Muslims, and you're not going to get along without them. I just don't understand what, and the way our politicians are going about it, they're not making it easier for us, I don't think.
That's right. That's what Plato said. Only the dead have seen the end of war.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Bill. Really appreciate this this recording, and this concludes it for today. And we'll come back for follow-ups on the additional times of your life.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, sir.